in Racine at 8:10. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they've not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. And don't forget Easter candy. They'll ship it to you. Check it out at jackandrea.com. The Morning Show is next. And we welcome you to the Morning Show on WGTV. I'm Gregory Berg. I have been tirelessly scouring the Morning Show archives in search of interviews that I thought might be interesting to listen to as we hunker down through the COVID-19 crisis. Today's program is an interesting interview from 2017 about creativity. I hope you enjoy it. What could be more exciting and important to talk about than creativity? And what it means to be creative, and what might be fueling one's own sense of creativity and hunger to be creative. I'm going to be speaking for the next few minutes of the Morning Show with the author of a very intriguing book called What's Your Creative Type? Harness the Power of Your Artistic Personality. It is the contention of the author, Meta Wagner, that each of us, as we look at our creative selves, can think of ourselves as falling into one or more of five different categories of creative types, each one not entirely exclusive of the others. But as we explore these various kinds of creative beings, we begin to see at least traces of ourselves. And by understanding what kind of creative person we ourselves might be, it helps us understand the way in which we can perhaps unlock our own creativity or nurture it, bring it to the fore, allow it to bloom, in a sense, most successfully and happily. Meta Wagner knows a lot about creativity. She actually teaches a course in creativity and also teaches creative writing at both Emerson College and Boston University. Her writings have appeared in the Huffington Post, Chicago Tribune, Salon Magazine, and on the Boston Globe on a regular basis. And this book, published by Seal Press, again is called "What's Your Creative Type? Harness the Power of Your Artistic Personality." Meta Wagner, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for that great setup.
Good. Well, I'm glad you think I know something about the book. I've read the book and enjoyed it very much. And I should let you know that in my other life away from the radio station, I'm a assistant professor of music at a local college. So much of my life is devoted to music and a fair amount of it to writing and so on. So even apart from the creative things I do here at the radio station, I'm busy in other creative endeavors as well. And I thought I knew a lot about creativity. And I realized as I read your book that actually a lot of the questions you confront us with in the book, I'd never really stopped to think about at all. And I'm really happy that your book has prompted me to kind of reflect on my own creative life instead of, in a sense, taking it for granted. How long have you been thinking about creativity itself in this sort of concerted fashion?
Several years, actually. I developed this course called Creativity in Context, has great alliteration, so you know it has to be good, at Emerson College several years ago, and I kept adding to it and researching more creative people in all of the arts, and the more I dug into it, the more it started to occur to me that I think a lot of these famous creators that we admire and emulate had something beyond sheer talent, and that something was their really clear awareness of why they were doing creative work. And I don't think we always ask ourselves the why. The focus a lot of times is on how and process instead.
Right.
So I want to shift over to the why and see if, you know, maybe if I could bring this to the public. I know so many struggling writers and other creative people. If we had a clearer sense of our own motivations, maybe that would be very helpful during those times when we get stuck, especially.
Question I wanted to be sure to get in, and I think I should ask it right now, is actually about the dedication of the book. And this ties in nicely to hearing a little more about your own creative life. You dedicate the book to your mother, long gone but always with you,
yes,
and your father, the greatest cheerleaders for creativity I could have ever asked for. Tell us more about why you dedicate the book in this way and why you feel such strong connection to them.
Yes, thank you for asking that. I had lost my mother when I was 17, very suddenly, and you know, of course, the loss and the shock of that lasted for, you know, really to this very day. But as it pertains to the book, they did cheerlead for me for any creative pursuits, whether they were successful or not. I tell a story in the book about their last wedding anniversary was their 25th, and we threw a surprise party for them. And the only way we could think of to get them downstairs at the same time was for me to tell them I'd just finished working on a painting, and I was really excited to show it to them. And I knew they would just follow each other down the stairs simultaneously. And that, I think, really emblemizes how they felt about whatever creative expression I had and just wanting to support it. You know, and creativity can come from the inside, but it oftentimes needs a lot of nurturing from the outside as well. And they did provide that to me, and I'm forever grateful for that.
Mm. Do you feel like, as you have lived your life, that the creative process has been a relatively natural and smooth one, or have there at least been periods in your life in which you have struggled with your own creative forces?
Absolutely struggled. The book is a prime example. I had the idea in mind for years. I had files and folders and documents. I had, you know, part of a book proposal done and half a chapter, and you would think somebody who studies creativity would be kind of good to go at that point. And I was stuck. You know, I just didn't know how to get off the mark. I didn't know how to take it from a very well thought through concept, I think, into a finished product, into reality. And I got a call out of the blue from a former student of mine who said, "Maida, I've just become a book agent. Do you know anybody working on a nonfiction project?" And I just blurted out, "Yes, me," without really even thinking about it. And once I said it, and once I could kind of visualize the idea of a book, maybe being on the bookshelves, talking to someone like you, that got me in gear. I'm somebody who needs that kind of external validation and motivation to do this kind of work. And in that moment, everything became clear to me. Mm-hmm. That was after years of struggling with it. So, you know, everybody has different things that motivate them. It doesn't mean you don't have internal resources, but some of us really need that kind of extra push.
Right.
And that's what the situation gave me.
Hmm. And so, in a sense, your book is one means to help creative types like you to function better, but also people who are other kinds of creative beings who create maybe with different goals in mind, to also help them understand their own creative impulses a little bit better. This might be a good time for us to maybe talk about the very notion of creativity itself, what you mean by that term, and the kind of people who should be concerned about this. And I ask that because I think it's possible that people are listening to this who think we are talking only about painters and poets and writers and composers and so on. And I suspect that when you think about creativity and teach people about creativity, that I am assuming at least that you are thinking in broader terms than that.
I really am. My focus in the book, or the research I've done, is on creative people in the performing and the creative arts and all these different genres. But the lessons learned, I think, could apply to somebody who develops software. You know, somebody, I have a friend who makes beautiful necklaces. It doesn't have to be what we think of as maybe the arts as being the premier kind of creative expression. I think you can find creative expression in so many different areas in life. And in fact, I'm getting some interest in this from the business community, and how can these lessons kind of be applied in the workplace. And so I'm really happy about that. You know, my research is kind of in what I love the most, which is the painters, composers, dancers, and all of that. But it definitely was with the intention of providing motivation for anybody with any kind of creative leanings. So I'm glad to be able to explain that.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Maida Wagner, who is the author of a book called What's Your Creative Type? Harness the Power of Your Artistic Personality. In this book, Maida Wagner outlines what we're about to explore in a little more detail, namely five different creative types. Another way to think of it is it's five different essential motivations that might be behind someone's creative efforts, or five different ways in which creativity can be deeply satisfying to a person. And it's her thought that if we better understand what is fueling our own hunger to be creative, that can help us, in a sense, be more successful in any and all of our creative endeavors. Before we finally take people out of their suspense and really outline these five creative types, just say a word about the process by which you came up with these five creative types. I mean, for essentially all of your as long as you've been thinking about creativity, have you kind of known this, or is this something you had to really think long and hard about?
I have not always known that, but what happened as I did more research into really hundreds of famous creators, from Pablo Picasso, Ernest Hemingway, Beyonce, you know, really across the board, and I started to realize and appreciate their clarity about their own motivations, it started to occur to me that there were five, in my point of view, overriding types of motivations, and that could be kind of represented by five different personality types. And the thought is, on the one hand, I think it's a fun way to think about it, but on the other hand, I think it's also a meaningful way to think about it. It's related to your identity. It's related to why you do the things you do. And in so many other areas of life, I think we're very clear about why we do what we do. But when it comes to creativity, I think a lot of people, especially those who don't do it professionally, but just do it for the love of it, may just give you answers like, oh, I enjoy it, or, you know, somebody told me I was good at it. But I think to really get started or get past blocks, it's helpful to have something more than just those sort of casual answers. And so hopefully identifying your type will give you some of those answers.
Absolutely. So let's spell them out for our listeners. And again, we should reiterate the fact that it's not that one is only going to be one of these and none of the others. And honestly, as I read this list of five, I saw traces of all of them in me, although I think there are one or two that are quite predominant, especially in the way that I go about creating. But enough about that. Let's spell out these five creative types for our listeners.
So the five creative types are the A-lister, the artisan, the game changer, the sensitive soul, and the activist. And I can describe each of those in a little more detail if you'd like.
Please.
So the A-lister is somebody who's motivated to make an impact on people, you know, make them laugh, make them cry, change the way they think about things. And they also want a lot of feedback, you know, they want that sort of adoration and applause, and they wouldn't mind a little bit of fame along the way, too. The artisan, you might think of as more of the purist. You know, they do something creative for the sheer love of it. They really enjoy mastering new techniques, learning new things, becoming better at something. But you could think of them as sort of like the backup singers. They don't need the spotlight on them. The game changers want to just take a field like, let's say, painting or music and just crash through conventions, do something entirely new, do something the world's never seen before because they're tired of the same old, same old. The sensitive soul, as the name kind of indicates, creates from really from a lot of emotion, wants to maybe achieve some kind of catharsis through creativity. Maybe they're coming to terms with some kind of loss or grief. And they also want to help other people. So I kind of think of that as paying it forward. So an example might be somebody writing a memoir of overcoming addiction, and could they help the reader in their own lives? And then the activist is somebody who's just trying to change the world, maybe save the world through art, through creative projects, really make an impact on changing things like poverty or civil rights and that sort of thing.
Hmm. It's a really interesting array. And one of the things that intrigued me was that it makes me think of other systems of analysis like the Myers-Briggs personality test, mm-hmm. in which you have these, I think, 16 different personality tests and possibilities. And one of the things that is done there is that all of them are framed essentially in very positive terms. And so somebody that we might easily call pushy and bossy is actually yeah. someone who's, you know, relishes being able to lead and, you know, galvanize or whatever. But, you know, there's a more positive way to describe right. that. And my, you know, perhaps this was not a similar kind of challenge, but my sense is that you really wanted us to feel relatively good about all of these. I mean, you did not favor one or the other intrinsically, even if one seems more like who we are. Probably the one that's hardest to spin in the most positive terms is the very first one, the A-changer, the A-lister, I should say, A-lister, where it seems like it's all about getting their name in lights. Did you struggle with that a little bit in terms of how to frame this and to make it not as distasteful a profile as it might seem to be at first glance?
You know what? I have a special place in my heart for the A-lister, actually. So, no, you know, it's like your children, you know, you love them all equally. I think there's definitely something positive in each of them. Something like the A-lister, you know, I have a great story in here about the Broadway actress Patti LuPone, and I don't label somebody's one thing or another, but she came to mind for me where she was told a story of her mother, a mother brought a daughter to come see her in the show Gypsy, and the daughter was very disinterested and didn't really want to be there with the mom. And then when LuPone belted out the showstopper, the daughter grabbed onto her mother's arm, and the mom said it was like they were transported. And when LuPone was told that story, she cried. So to me, that's because she was so moved that she had that impact on an audience. So, you know, the fame and all of that is sort of a a sideshow, I think, for a lot of people who might be the A-lister type, but to feel like they can pour themselves into something and have that kind of impact, I think is, you know, is really something to aspire to. So, no, I love all the types, but they all have their shadow side, and I do cover that in the book as well.
Right. I mean, for instance, within the A-lister, we're given a number of different varieties within that, some of which, at least to me, are a little more attractive than others.
Right.
You say something really interesting at one point when you say, as an A-lister, the form of creativity you are most drawn to and the degree of audience responsiveness it invites might be a clue to your deepest needs. Understanding this about yourself is not only interesting, it can help guide you toward the forms of creative expression and careers that suit you best. Tell us more about that and about how that might work.
Yeah, I think if you're, you know, writers, you know, we imagine them sort of huddled behind their laptops, maybe at a coffee shop, and almost isolated and solitary. And yet I think a lot of writers have that A-lister kind of aspect to them as well. They want to be able to imagine somebody reading something they've written and having some sort of response to it, hopefully a positive response, or be moved by it. And so I think, you know, you have to stick with what appeals to you the most. But if you're somebody who really needs to be on a lot and be have an audience, a live audience at all times, writing is probably not going to satisfy you, and something in the performing arts is something that you could probably draw more satisfaction from. You know, somebody like a stand-up comic, if they're up there and nobody's laughing, it crushes them. They need that laughter. They need that sort of applause and positive response. And you need to kind of know that about yourself, I think, how much you need that external validation versus how much you can work in isolation and be satisfied with what you achieved for yourself.
You spend part of this chapter talking about the matter of competitiveness.
Yes.
Does it just stand to reason that someone who is an A-lister will be then almost certainly more of a competitive being who will relish that aspect of their creative endeavors?
I think they do go hand in hand quite well. I will tell you personally, I have been shamelessly checking the hot new releases list on Amazon hourly. So, you know, is that sort of a thing you really want? You pour so much into something you've done, and you want to see it succeed. And then, you know, there's a matter of can you engage in a friendly competition with others? Or is it more of a vicious kind of competition? And one example I have in the book about friendly competition is as a songwriting team for the Beatles, John Lennon and Paul McCartney, you know, their producer, George Martin, really talked about it as a friendly competition where they would try to one-up each other, but in the end, it was striving for the same goal. And in fact, very early on, they decided to put both their names on all compositions that they did, even if only one or the other did it. And that would sort of ensure, it was very smart because they were very young to have come up with this, it would ensure that they were on the same page and kind of striving for the same things because they would both get credit and they would both get the money regardless of who did more of the work on Yesterday versus another song. So this friendly competition, and then I have a story about two street artists, Banksy, who's very famous, and Robo, who is famous in London especially, and theirs was much more vicious, painting over each other's work, having kind of teams of supporters who put each other down. So it can take different forms, but I think it's part of an A-lister's drive to see where they stand in relation to others. It may not be the most appealing aspect of them, but it's also a driving factor.
Each of the five chapters of the book includes a portion that is headlined Cautionary Tales. So,
yes.
For instance, in this first chapter, there is a portion titled Cautionary Tales for the A-lister. And once you have spelled out some of the ways in which an A-lister, in a sense, derives their fuel for what they do. Then we hear some of these cautionary tales, that is, maybe points of concern for the typical A-lister that are also important to remember. So, for instance, explain to our listeners how an A-lister might have some problem when it comes to balancing product and process.
Yeah, there's a book I really love called The Creative Habit by the great choreographer Twyla Tharp. And in it, she has this creativity survey. One of her questions is, which do you value more as you're doing some kind of creative work, the process or the product? And by that, I believe she means, do you get absorbed in the work itself, or are you always thinking ahead to commercial viability, audience response, sales, and all of that? And studies have actually shown that for students who are in art school, the ones who were more absorbed in the process and worried less about commercial success ended up having done better, I think it was 10 years later. And I think that's a lesson to be learned for people who would consider themselves A-listers. You know, don't lose sight of just the joy of doing something creative, and don't be so consumed with the impact it's going to have that you don't really focus in on the work itself.
As long as we're focusing here, I think it behooves us to just take a minute or two and talk about the other two cautionary tales here for the A-lister. And again, with the understanding, we won't do this exhaustively with all of the other creative types, but it gives our listeners a good sense of just how thoroughly your book explores all of this. You also say that for the A-lister typically might have a problem in terms of what kind of expectations to have for themselves and for others as well. And I can identify with this a lot. I've seen the way in which this can get people into a lot of trouble when it comes to their own creativity. How should an A-lister manage their own expectations?
Yeah, the author of Wild, Cheryl Strayed, had also written an advice column called Dear Sugar for the website called The Rumpus, and she had received a letter from an aspiring writer who basically said she was stuck because, I think a lot of people do this, if I can't be the next great Hemingway, you know, what's the point? And how daunting is that? Because we can't all be the next great Hemingway, so are you going to give up entirely? So as she points out, there's some struggle between very almost overly elevated goals and expectations and then an undervaluing of yourself where you don't have the confidence to go forward within your own capabilities and knowing that you can always improve. And then you're stuck nowhere. You can't move ahead because it may not match the vision you have for yourself, and then you end up doing nothing. So if somebody's an A-lister type and they fall into this sort of conundrum, you have to ask yourself, would I rather have produced a no book, or would I rather have produced a really good book that isn't the great American novel, but is really good, and people are really enjoying, and I'm really, you know, proud that I did it. So I think that's a really important one to look out for. Don't get stuck in that middle place where you can't move forward.
Yeah, that can be a terribly frustrating place to be. You also say that the typical A-lister might really have tendencies towards being a control freak. And this, of course, can get very dicey, especially when you have a couple of A-listers working in close proximity to one another, and also an A-lister working in proximity with others who are not nearly so strong-willed in that same respect. It's really interesting to think about the various ways in which this can spur problems of one kind or another.
Yeah, I think we all have a lot of control issues. In one sense, the A-lister's controlling nature can be very beneficial to their art. You know, they really think through different aspects of it, how they want to be, how they want to accomplish something. I think in terms of collaboration, We'll get to artisan, I'm sure, but there are certain different types that sort of are more open to that, more open to the influence of predecessors, more open to collaborating with others and not having to, let's say, take over the recording session or to have it their way all the time. And that's something an A-lister who is ego-driven has to watch out for, because you wouldn't want to miss out on fantastic opportunities for collaboration because your ego got in the way.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Maida Wagner, and we're talking about her newest book, which is called What's Your Creative Type? Harness the Power of Your Artistic Personality. In it, she explores five different creative types. The A-lister is essentially someone who really creates for the sake of achieving great success, the name and lights sort of scenario. And yeah. Although there might be other motivations beneath it, this is what fuels them as much as anything. I have to say, by the way, I mentioned before we went on the air that I happen to spend a great deal of my life in various creative endeavors, and I see a little bit of myself in a lot of these factors. I have to say that a whole lot of what fuels my creative endeavors is around this notion of the A-lister.
I hear you.
Although it's funny, it's not so much in the sense of name and lights, although it's really pretty cool when you, for instance, compose a piece of music that complete strangers in another state are performing. That's pretty cool. Quite exciting. But I must say that that when I, for instance, write a certain piece of music, as much as anything, I long for instance, a colleague of mine in the music department, not necessarily a particular one, but somebody who is a colleague, to step forward and say, that's a great piece, Greg. That I really liked. That was one of the highlights of the concert. I mean,
yeah,
in a sense,
yeah.
I wish that didn't feed my soul as much as it does. I wish that my own inner peace and inner pleasure were more what it was about. But to be perfectly honest, a lot of it is fueled by that. And I don't think I was even all that aware of that uncomfortable truth until reading your book. And it's probably important for a lot of people who are creative to be honest about this, and especially to understand the way in which this can get in their own way.
Absolutely. I love that story. You know, we had mentioned my parents before, and after my mother was gone, I was in college. I kind of hadn't found my people, you know what I mean, to share. At the time, I did a lot of painting and drawing and writing, and I think that loss really reinforced to me the need for others, the need for an encouraging audience. And I'm not talking about anything false or people saying, oh, that's great, when they don't really mean it. That is not, I don't think, what most A-listers want, but they do want some sort of feedback and some sort of appreciation for their efforts and hopefully to have this impact on people. And I really kind of shut down creatively, and I think, you know, people should accept whatever motivates them. The A-lister might sound like a little too narcissistic or ego-driven at times, but I think if you and I and others are just honest with ourselves and say, it's not that so much, it's just really we like that connection with people, and we like that sort of interpersonal relationship with people around our art. And I think that's, I think whatever works for you, you need to work with it instead of like fighting it, basically.
Right, exactly. And I think for me where it gets a little muddy is that I like to think of myself as an artisan. But in a sense, I'm also anxious to create excellence. And for me, the confirmation of something that I have created being excellent is, in a sense, what I receive from people whose opinion I value the most. And
right.
So in that respect, those factors, I suppose, can kind of walk hand in hand.
Absolutely. You know, I think with any typology, it's a great way of thinking about oneself and maybe opens some doors to thinking about oneself. And then, you know, even if you look up your horoscope and you say, okay, well, those eight things really do, like, shockingly describe me, but I've got two over in this other sign also, you know, so it's, and the book is written so that anybody, I have the feeling most people will kind of go to the chapter that they think best describes them, but I'm hoping they'll go back and read the other chapters, because you'll definitely discover other aspects within yourself, too, because nobody's one thing, and as Walt Whitman said, we all contain multitudes, so it's, you know, it's a kind of cool, clear way of thinking about oneself, but I don't think anybody's just one thing in all aspects of creativity.
Of course, of course. In fact, one of the ways in which I think you nicely sum up the complexity of this is at the very end of the chapter about A-listers, when you say, if you're an A-lister or someone with A-lister tendencies, you're ambitious as all get out, are vulnerable to what others think, and feel most alive in the spotlight. And I really like how that sums up quite a lot of what we're talking about, and even in that summary, one gets a real sense of the complexity of it. The second chapter is devoted to the artisan, and I think as you try to help us understand kind of what the artisan is all about, there is this notion, you say, that they would do the work they love, mm-hmm. whether or not they received any compensation for it, or even any acknowledgement by others that it exists, or that they exist. That's a really interesting question. That's a really interesting question that I suppose any creative type or artistic type could pose to themselves, and it's interesting to think about what the answer to that might be in their heart of hearts.
I was really fascinated by that, I guess because it wasn't me, and I thought, wow, how do you keep everything just in a, you know, in the old file cabinet, and not have it bother you, you know? I have plenty of things in the old file cabinet and the desktop and all of that, but they bug me, you know, it bothers me that I never did something with it, never showed it to anyone, that kind of thing. Somebody like the poet, the great poet, Emily Dickinson, wrote 1,800 poems in her lifetime and published fewer than a dozen. You know, we always refer to her as a recluse, and she really does seem to have only shown her work to a few close people. And yet it did not deter her in the least from spending what I can only imagine was every day writing poetry, to have amassed that kind of collection of work, and, you know, outstanding work as well. So I think about that, or a more current example, there's a great documentary out called Finding Vivian Maier. It's a woman who, in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, was a nanny, but went around just taking pictures all the time, and this filmmaker came across this sort of treasure trove of her work at a flea market, and undeveloped rolls upon rolls of film, hundreds and I think maybe even thousands of rolls of film, not even developed. And when he developed them, famous photographers were super impressed with her sense of composition, some of her social commentary, you know, and all that. So it's some of this might be people who have been marginalized at different times, and some of it I think is just by choice. It was just the work itself that was satisfying.
Hmm. One of the observations I especially enjoyed in this chapter was when you talked about the artisan managing to avoid being intimidated by all that has come before. And it's where you kind of confront this notion of the tabula rasa, the blank slate, and how a given person might be really intimidated by the notion that so much greatness has been already created before them, and what could I possibly have to add to that? And I think you're suggesting here that the artisan is someone who maybe better than some others, is really able to, in a sense, step into that breach more boldly than others, because they somehow know that they have something worthwhile to create.
Yeah, you know, I think we might think of the artisan, because I said they don't need the spotlight, as being a little not having a strong ego, maybe, but I don't perceive it that way. Just going back to the Emily Dickinson example for a moment, what kind of ego must you have to not even need to show it to anyone and get that acclaimed? You know what I mean? It's almost, you could say, that's a stronger ego, to know within yourself how good you are and to keep doing the work. And I think this notion sometimes, some people want to just feel like they appeared on the scene fully formed, you know, not influenced by previous artists. Some people like Picasso and Hemingway. It's not to say they didn't acknowledge previous people, but they definitely want to feel like they were originals and didn't really want to give maybe due credit at times. I think the artisan has a different kind of personality and is happy to give credit, happy to say, you know, I'm sure there are musicians you would easily acknowledge that you've been influenced by. And I kind of came up with this, the image that came to mind was, you know, the childhood toy I had at least called an Etch-a-Sketch, and I know it still exists, and no matter how you shake it, it still had those little kind of shadows of the scribbles that came before. And I kind of was thinking about creativity that way. You can't get rid of those little shadows because you've been reading, looking at art, listening to music, looking at buildings and design, you know, our whole lives. So, of course, we're pulling in all these influences. And an artisan is just fine with acknowledging that.
Hmm. In many ways, the artistic type of these five that I found personally the most foreign, the strangest, the one least like me, is the third, the game changer, anxious to create something that has truly never existed before. But just because this isn't me doesn't mean I didn't find this chapter thoroughly interesting as I did the whole book. And again, I found myself particularly drawn to some of the cautionary tales involving game changers who, by their very nature, are going to be especially courageous in what they do. But, for instance, they maybe need to be careful to foster what might be difficult for them, qualities like patience. How can patience be a problem for the game changer?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think a lot of people in the business world probably recognize themselves in this quality. You know, I think one story that really kind of conveys this is the writer Truman Capote, who of course wrote In Cold Blood, had this idea for two full decades that he wanted, and this seems very common to us now, but at the time this was something bold and new, take all the techniques of fiction, characterization, description of place and setting and all of that, and bring it to a real-life story. And he just saw a little clip in a newspaper of a terrible murder of an entire family in Kansas by these two guys who I think got something, a very small amount of money from the household. So it all seemed like, why did they even do this? And he convinced the New Yorker magazine that they should send him there to not just do an investigative report, but really get into the mindset of Perry, who was kind of the ringleader of these two, and did such detailed, beautiful, complex characterization like you would find in a novel. But it took 20 years that he had to sit on that idea before somebody said, yeah, let's give that a whirl, and would accept it. You know, the two different genres were kept very separate. It was journalism here and nonfiction, and fiction here and never the twain shall meet. And he broke through that. But it won't always happen overnight.
Right. I really appreciated that in this chapter, all the chapters have a section called Spotlight, in which you talk about very specific artists and their experience as it is apropos to the matter at hand. That in this particular chapter, you you spend some time talking about various creative people who have had to endure very harsh critical rejection.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, that's what happens when you're a Beethoven and you're really plowing new ground. But what's really interesting to me is that the array of people you talk about in this particular chapter range from Gertrude Stein and Herman Melville to Jay-Z. So in other words, you're casting your net far and wide, and that, of course, it makes a lot of sense in writing a book like this.
Yeah, I was really trying to look at just artists and creative people from all different genres, from different generations and centuries even, though most of the emphasis is on 20th and 21st century. But somebody like Jay-Z, you know, I believe he would probably identify with being a game changer. And the game changers have to have that. They're going to be subject to more rejection and criticism than anyone else because they're trying to do something that flies in the face of convention. And even critics can be kind of put off by that at times. And so in Jay-Z's case, you know, he was turned down by every record label and then ended up co-founding his own. That takes guts, you know, and that takes a certain vision and a commitment to doing something new and different. So game changers, you know, they're kind of very motivated to do something bold. And at the same time, they're going to be receiving probably a lot of rejection and criticism. There are some exceptions to that. Somebody like Lin-Manuel Miranda, of course, the creator of Hamilton, boy, did he receive immediate acceptance for that beyond anyone's wildest dream, probably. But he was doing game-changing things by placing people of color to play the roles of the founding fathers and really bringing hip-hop to Broadway. So I think he's one of the rare game changers who seems to have reached critical and commercial success very quickly. A lot of times it's a long road.
Hmm. And you go on, of course, to explore the creative lives of the sensitive soul and of the activist out to change the world. And then you kind of draw it all together. And in our last minute or so, I want to lift up a line that you you bring out, which I think is important, when you say creativity is a mystery, one not meant to be fully solved. It's good to embrace this mystery, knowing that the source of your creativity can be elusive, impossible to pinpoint. It's an important point to make, even after having explored creativity and its various facets to such a careful degree.
Yes, I think it's one thing to know your motivations, but that doesn't necessarily explain the full source of creativity and how you could wake up one day with you know, song lyrics, as Paul McCartney did with yesterday. I'm sorry, not the lyrics, but the melody completely in his mind. And I think a lot of us have had some kind of experience like that, where you just don't even know. John Lennon said something about channeling something from, you know, from who knows. And I love having the mystery of that, too. So I think, you know, the motivations, I think, should be clear. The source of creativity, where does it even come from? Let's just accept that as a mystery. Why not?
Hmm. The book, again, is called What's Your Creative Type? Harness the Power of Your Artistic Personality. The book is published by Seal Press, the author, Maida Wagner. Maida Wagner, I really enjoyed your book, and I really enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you. Thank you so much,
thank
and best
you.
Wishes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I enjoyed this.
Tomorrow on the podcast edition of The Morning Show, the interview that was scheduled for today, Michael Joseph Gross and a very entertaining book titled Starstruck, When a Fan Gets Close to Fame. And then on Sunday, Also out of the archives for the podcast, Franz Weissner and his wonderful memoir called Honeymoon with My Brother. Next week, we'll have a number of interesting morning show interviews that relate to the COVID-19 crisis, including a conversation with Dr. Ed Kawakami from Carthage on the rather involved process by which Carthage came to decide to modify its grading system for this spring semester.